Live from New York, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're here to empower people. We have people listening at radio stations, over the telephone, over the internet, all over the world. So what are the issues that could make a difference? Well, health and nutrition. Showing you both what we do wrong that we could correct to stop a problem. For example, today from the University of Southern California, a study on processed meats. That's bologna and pastrami. And how that increases your risk of breast cancers. We're also going to look at other studies involving what we can do right. For example, the right kind of full-spectrum lighting is important, but what about the high-energy efficient bulbs that are out there? Do you know that they're linked to anxiety, migraines, even cancer? The Germans' federal experiment on this in their environmental agency, equivalent to our EPA, it can cause dizziness, cluster headaches, migraines, seizures, fatigue, inability to concentrate, and anxiety. And these are the energy-efficient bulbs. And yet we're told those are the bulbs to use. Not the right idea. But improving your lifestyle, according to Umeå University in Sweden, will lower your cholesterol and make you less susceptible to cardiac death. And SAMe, that's a nutrient. It boosts your mood and makes you feel a lot better. And plus other things on health and healing. Also, there's a problem about how many psychiatric drugs we're taking. I don't believe we should be taking any, but I'm going to give you the latest information on that. Then we're going to go directly to a guest. We have two guests today. The first is a Conversations with Remarkable Minds. These are individuals that you have decided are the most interesting people you hear on the air. And we're going to talk about, first off, with Dr. Jim Garrison, Raising Spiritual Values to Create a Caring Economy. Dr. Jim Garrison is the founding president of Ubiquity University and the Wisdom School of Graduate Studies. He is well known as a scholar and humanitarian, and he used to be the co-founder and president of the Gorbachev Foundation. He also was instrumental in founding the State of the World Forum, to lay a template for a more sustainable global civilization. The second guest after the half hour will be John Perkins. John's going to also continue with our Conversations with Remarkable Minds. He's a part of that series. He's going to share things you've not heard before. The new economic hitmen in politics and business. So when you ask, why are we involved in creating coups in Honduras? Why are we regime changing in Syria or Lebanon? What are we doing in the Ukraine? He will be able to answer that and show you that it's not just when he was a economic hitman. He was there when the Saudi Arabian money laundering scandal was going on. He was there at the fall of the Shah of Iran, the assassinations of Ecuador and Panama's democratically elected presidents, and other government and corporate intrigues. He was at the heart of all that. He was the one who would go in and make an offer, a bribe, to the head of a country. If you play with our rules and allow us to exploit your resources with different private corporations, you'll be rewarded. If not, you'll be killed. He'll give us specific examples, but we're not going back. He's going to show us what's going on today. So those are just some of the issues. Now, if time permits, I'm also going to play a new clip, audio clip, on the war on drugs, why it cannot be won, but what we should do in its place, and also the final speech of Martin Luther King. It's a short speech, but very relevant. So let's start by looking at the latest on health and healing and what we can do, especially when it comes to our diet, because this is something we have a choice over. This is from the University of Southern California. Specifically, the amount of bacon, sausage, which is both from the pig, just the different seasonings and processed meats like bologna, have increased the risk of breast cancer. That's according to the latest study. This was published in the current Journal of Cancer Causes and Control. And it suggests that race, ethnicity, genetics, and culture and lifestyle choices could all affect cancer risk. And, quote, few studies look at breast cancer risk factors specific to Latinas. Our focus was to understand if meat consumption is associated with breast cancer and whether there's a difference between Latinas and white women. To our knowledge, this is the first study that has looked at meat intake among Latinas. The findings came months after the World Health Organization declared processed meat a carcinogen that increases the risk of colorectal cancer and breast cancer. This group was on the fence about concluding that processed meat intake may cause breast cancer and ultimately decided not to make that edict based upon insufficient data. So now there's this new study that says, yes, processed meat does cause it. And in the study, Latinas who consumed about 20 grams, that's per day, that's the amount of meat that would be in one forkful. If you looked at your plate and you saw one tiny little piece of meat, that's 20 grams. It's not even an ounce. That's enough. That's one strip of bacon. You're 42% more likely to be diagnosed with breast cancer. So it makes a big difference compared to those that don't eat meat at all. So for the African-American population, for the Latina population, where you have an enormous amount of meat in the diet, frequently it's pork in different forms. It's in stews. It's generally white rice with pork and beans. Get it out. Try going vegan. Now, let's say that you have people in your family, because of their taste preferences, they don't want to give up the meat. All right, then do the following. Go into a health food store, go to the dairy section, and they will have vegan tempeh. They have brands of bacon and sausages that are made with soy or coconut and have their organic, non-GMO, gluten-free, and they taste just like bacon or just like sausage. Now, for those people who need a transition moment, that provides it. In my own family, I couldn't get one of my brothers to stop eating bologna sandwiches. So what I found was I found some vegan, really high-quality vegan, organic, no MSG, and I would make him a hot dog, and he liked a hot dog with mustard and onions and relish. Well, it was on a gluten-free bun made from sprouted flour. It had organic relish that I personally made, and it had diced up tomatoes and a sweet onion that was organic, and this vegan meat. He could not tell the difference, but it wasn't harming him, and that's the important. It wasn't causing inflammation, and it wasn't causing cancer. So there are people who can't go cold turkey. Others need a transition food, like rice milk, coconut milk, almond milk, cashew milk, hemp milk instead of cow's milk. So they still want to have something in a hot cereal or in a shake or a smoothie. Fine, there's transition foods. There's all forms of dairy-free ice creams that are delicious. And again, they're made from all good ingredients. But stay away if you're African-American, if you're Latino, if you're Caucasian, stay away from eating any of the processed meats at all, because that study is important. For a lot of people, they thought they were doing the right things by getting this new generation of energy-saving light bulbs. That's good. And everybody started buying them and throwing out the old ones. Here's the problem, and this is from Germany's Federal Environmental Agency. This is like our EPA. Quote, many of us in the effort to save energy and money replaced our old standard light bulbs with environmentally friendly new generation light bulbs. However, the new generation of energy efficient light bulbs are so toxic that the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency created an emergency protocol you need to follow in the event of a bulb breaking due to the poison gas that is released. If broken indoors, these light bulbs release 20 times the maximum acceptable mercury concentration in the air, according to a study conducted by researchers at the Wilhelm Clauditz Institute for Germany's Federal Environmental Agency. Energy-efficient light bulbs can cause dizziness, cluster headaches, migraines, seizures, fatigue, inability to concentrate, and anxiety. Energy-efficient bulbs can cause even cancer and therefore go back to the incandescent bulbs. And that's because they contain mercury, and mercury is a potent neurotoxin that is especially dangerous to children and pregnant women. And it's especially toxic to the brain and the nervous system and the liver and the kidneys. It can also damage the cardiovascular, immune, and reproductive systems. And it can lead to tremors, anxiety, insomnia, memory loss, headaches, cancer, and Alzheimer's. So you have to be aware of this. You have styrene, an unsaturated liquid hydrocarbon obtained as a petroleum byproduct. They're in there. You have other mildly acidic, toxic, white crystalline solid materials obtained from coal tar that's used in the bulb itself. So who knew that these bulbs would be so toxic? So the old is actually better. Also, a good study from Umeå University in Sweden published in the European Heart Journal, and it says that the most common risk factors for heart attacks is elevated cholesterol. And what they have found over the last 20 years in Sweden is that it's not the drugs that cause the reduction, but rather it is improved lifestyle. And they did this at several major hospitals and found in general a decrease in cholesterol levels, especially in older people, and because they were changing, eating more vegetables, more whole grains, more fiber in the diet, and healthier fats. So that's good news. So diet, blood pressure came down. Diet, diabetes came down. Diet, previous heart attack or stroke, you didn't have another one after that. So it saves your life. So what are we looking at? We're looking at it principally a plant-based, organic, healthy diet. And finally, Sammy. Now, for those of you who are looking for a way of boosting moods, especially if you've had intermittent or kind of low-level depression, Sammy has been shown to be as effective as prescription drugs in improving mood and a lot of other health conditions. And while some people have severe mood disorders, most everyone experiences the blues from time to time. And being a methyl donor, Sammy plays a role in the methylation production of the neurotransmitter serotonin and dopamine. And serotonin and dopamine, as this audience knows, are the main feel-good neurotransmitters which can improve mood and well-being. People suffering from depression have lower levels of Sammy in their spinal fluid, and up to 46% of the people with depression have only a partial or no response to antidepressant medications. And one of the main obstacles preventing prescribed medications from being effective is their inability to cross the blood-brain barrier. Sammy can cross the blood-brain barrier, and it can help increase the levels and in people, and that reduces symptoms of depression. And this was borne out by several studies in just over 6 weeks, and it was compared to the SSRI or Effexor. and that you don't want to take these SSRIs, these selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. And they did this, and it worked. It also turns off inflammation in your joints, turns off inflammation in your head, your brain. Your liver is involved in many crucial functions, like storing nutrients and getting rid of toxins. So it comes no surprise that the health of your liver affects the health of your whole body. Well, glutathione is involved in phase one liver detoxification. And without glutathione, your liver is damaged after exposure to toxins like alcohol, cadmium, mercury, lead. And since SAMe is a precursor to glutathione, it makes sense that it's been shown to protect liver cells from oxidative stress and inflammation caused by toxins. And it's just so good for your brain. It can help prevent cancer. Why? Because methyl donors like SAMe are essential for the functioning of enzymes required by your DNA to repair themselves, and that protects you from cancer, and especially breast cancer. And also, you don't need a lot of it. Generally, 500 milligrams a day of SAMe. It's natural and won't have any harmful side effects. That's the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a break and come back with our first guest and talk about raising spiritual values to create a caring economy. And anyone who saw the presidential debates, I think, wasn't that what all of them were talking about? No. Back in a moment. Let's go out now to Mill Valley, California. We're standing by as Dr. Jim Garrison. Hi, Jim.
Hello.
Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you. I
want people to know that Jim is the founding president of Ubiquity University and the Wisdom School of Graduate Studies, an international school for higher education built upon innovative principles of whole brain and whole system learning. The university operates on four continents with partners in the European Union, India, Mexico, South Africa, Russia, Vietnam, and others. And as the co-founder and president of the Gorbachev Foundation, Jim was instrumental in the founding of the State of the World Forum to lay a template for a more sustainable global civilization. And in the late 80s, he served as the executive director of the Esalen Institute of Soviet American Exchange and founded the International Foreign Policy Association in collaboration with Secretary of State George Shultz. And he has done a lot of work. He's a graduate in religion theology from Harvard and Cambridge universities. His website is wisdomuniversity.org and ubiquityuniversity.org. Jim, when we look at the circus of candidates that Americans have to choose from, with the exception of Jill Stein, and the fact that both Clinton and Trump are the popular celebrities of the day, it should be obvious to any person with consciousness that the U.S. is officially spiritually bankrupt, certainly in the halls of private and federal leadership, except for Sanders on many issues and Jill Stein. The underlying platform that generates voter support is individualism, personal selfishness, greed, hatred, division, whether between social classes, races, religions, or the U.S. versus the rest of the world. We saw that last night in the debate. We don't hear any references to universal values and human decency and respect, such as compassion, kindness, genuine equality, interfaith harmony, and solidarity, and so much more that are critical for the U.S. to move towards passing legislation that might show we are a caring economy. On the right, we hear fundamentalist paternal rhetoric that reflects a god of judgment, spite, and revenge, and on the left, spirituality simply disappears into the ether of their angst altogether, and tends to be overtly rationalist and reductionist. So if you had to speak on the historical evolution of values and morals and ethics during the past 40, 50 years, from the, let's say the 1960s, when we were looking at these issues, embracing these issues, to now, what would that trajectory look like?
Well, that's a very profound question, Gary, and you may know that my last book was called America as Empire, in which I just sort of analyzed American history within the context of the rise and fall of imperial systems. And what happened last night in the Republican debate is so sadly and tragically exemplomatic of what happens when an imperium begins to fall. And one of the transitions is that the public surrenders the notion of civic virtue and the common good that builds a country, that builds a community, that builds an empire, as it were, for personal entitlement. Because at the apogee moment of an empire, the power of the polity is centralized in fewer hands, the 1%, as Bernie Sanders calls it, and Occupy called it. But that's a historically predictable phenomenon for imperial systems that have reached the point of satiated wealth and corruption. And then the public, seeing that, figures, well, why should we care any more than the elite care? And so civic virtue is replaced across the board with personal entitlement. And then if you look at the history of Rome, if you look at many other imperial systems, you then have a Trump phenomenon where a bully basically comes into the public arena that is corrupt but governed by inherited procedures, like in the Roman Republic. But then a guy comes in like Trump, like Sulla, if you remember your Roman history, and completely violates all the rules. People are scandalized by the fact that this guy is coming in and breaking all these sacred protocols of how you actually run for president. And this guy takes over. And he takes over because, as Toynbee pointed out in his monumental work on the history of civilization and the history of empire, he studied all the civilizations, all the empires. He says one of the things that happens when there emerges a 1% and people no longer agree on the common good is that that imperial system loses what he calls its elasticity. And you could see it in the Republican debate last night. They're locked into a worldview that's, first of all, completely disconnected from reality and getting more and more extreme because of its disconnection. You've got the guy at the middle of the stage, Donald Trump, oozing with intimidational self-assurance, I would say, that is literally frightening the other candidates, at some level frightening the populace, but people are so desperate now for some kind of breakthrough in the paralysis of Washington politics that if you look at the polls around Trump, the reason why he's now at nearly 50% of the Republicans and he's getting a lot of the old Reagan Democrats is because people know that only a guy like Trump is sufficiently strong to break the paralysis that is torturing the country and year by year, week by week, where you can't get anything done. So there's a desperation building in the country that I believe is fracturing between Trump on the right, a Bernie Sanders on the left. But at the heart of it, people are wanting a strong man, and that's what came out of the Weimar Republic in Germany. That's what came with Charles de Gaulle after the collapse of the Vichy Republic in France. So what's happening with Trump is, first of all, historically predicted by many situations, and we in America really need to get that unless we get it together very, very quickly. I don't know what's going to happen on the Republican side, but as you all know, it's unprecedented what's happening in the Republican pathway to the nomination. And whether the Democrats can stand against it, whoever they nominate, is a real open question. You know, we could be heading into martial law. I mean, the other point, and then I'll close, but this is such an important question that you're asking, Gary. You know, if you look back even at the last week, you know, you have the former head of the CIA. You have people in the military. This is the first time in American history that I know of that the military has and the CIA have begun publicly to insert themselves around stopping a guy like Trump. But that's going to take either something extra legal and extra constitutional, because it looks like he's gaining in popularity, because we've got, you know, what Robert Kagan in the op-ed in the Washington Post a couple of days ago said, we have what he called plutocracy and populism conflating in one strong man, as the Republicans are now voting for a man that the Republicans and Fox News have been fomenting for the last 20 years. So what he said, as a neoconservative, it was just a shocking thing for somebody like him to make this statement in print in an op-ed. Trump represents everything that the Republicans have been arguing for and Fox News arguing for 20 years. When you go night by night spousing hate and division and fear and xenophobia, you get Donald Trump. But then when the Donald Trump really shows up, everybody freaks out and says, well, this isn't really who we need. But the American population now is in for a day of reckoning that I think is going to be tragic if we don't immediately find our pathway to the common good.
Our entire economic policy out of Washington remains based upon a top-down model.
Totally.
A top-driven corporate economy in pursuit of wealth. And is it even possible to incorporate compassion and empathy in such a pursuit of wealth and social change?
Well, you know, it's interesting. In the midst of neoliberalism that through the Ex-Im Bank and the World Bank and the WTO, the World Trade Organization, et cetera, the world and many communities are being ravished and rapaciously exploited. There's a phenomenon that's been bursting out over the last number of years called the benefit corporation. Ubiquity University, in fact, is a benefit corporation. And it's now in almost all 50 states. It's the fastest growing economic model out there in the world today, spreading into Europe, spreading into Latin America. And what a benefit corporation is exactly what you're calling for. It's a corporation that by its constitutional bylaws and by the laws of California, for example, the California authorized benefit corporations in January of 2012, and we established Ubiquity as a benefit corporation in March of 2012, so we were one of the first organizations in California to jump through the benefit corporation legal hoops to establish a company with shareholders. It's a classic C corp in that regard, but it states that the social mission of the company overrides the return to the shareholders, and that is how the company will be run, and that gives us protection. One of the reasons, for example, that Whole Foods is so rapacious is because it is not a social benefit corporation. It's a classic C corp, and therefore, by law, it has to give priority to the profit to its shareholders. And that's why the social benefit corporation is such a powerful new model of how a company can do business, because it brings in ethics, it brings in the common good. In our case, it's to provide transformational and affordable education to young people around the world. And so I think in the heart of darkness, as it were, of the current capitalist system that looks as if it's taken over the rest of the world and is never going to go away. But I would remind people that the Soviet Union and totalitarian communism didn't look like it was going to go away until about 1985, and then it finally collapsed in 1991 with the, you know, the ascendancy of Mikhail Gorbachev and just the collapse of an old order. You know, I think what another point that I would make of the Republican Party is that it's, we're really also experiencing the last gasp of an order that is no longer tenable in the United States, as Bernie Sanders is pointing out, and is no longer tenable worldwide. So there's this emergence of civil society, there's the emergence of the benefit corporations, and as the I Ching says, the best way to combat evil is that make energetic progress in the good. That's what we're trying to do at Ubiquity. I know that's what you're trying to do with your radio show. And by the way, I really applaud. I was just listening in on your last remarks around diet and getting away from meat. That's another part of it. To the degree to which all of the listeners listening in today would take seriously what you said about just managing our diet. A study came out last week saying that it is the consumers that are the greatest cause of climate change. So our choices, day by day and week by week, as to whether we're going to eat meat or not, whether we're going to have non-GMO food or not, organic or commercially grown, those decisions are as important as what our governments are negotiating in Paris through the United Nations, you know, Committee on Parties, the COPs, year by year. So there's a lot happening out there in the world today, and so as dark as it seems when you look at the Republican debate, and as dangerous as a guy like Donald Trump is, in the end, we, through our choices, by becoming a benefit corporation, if anybody listening to me today has a company, consider becoming a benefit corporation. And if all the companies in the United States would become benefit corporations, we would have the kind of a caring economy that that we all know that we need.
That really answers so much of what I was hoping that to share with this audience. My final question for you, Jim, is, for many of us in the progressive movement, and I'm thinking of Chris Hedges, Henry Giroux, Andrew Harvey, yourself, and others, the corporate national security and surveillance militarized government is fully entrenched in our body politic and is going away not soon, but could, if we the people are willing to step outside the mechanisms of power to exert pressure upon the entire system in an act of protest, defiance, and unity. The question is, how can independent and truly progressive elected officials who sympathize with this view but have no power serve as catalysts to help guide grassroots efforts to strengthen participatory democracy, which is eroding rapidly? And as a follow-up, how might spiritual principles and higher values, especially altruism, then be aligned to a bottom-driven economy, an economy that develops at local levels and is rooted in protest rather than somewhere out of Washington or Wall Street?
Well, that's in some ways, Gary, the $64,000 question. You know, in the face of overwhelming darkness, how do you make your candle shine brightly enough to make a difference? And how do you collaborate with other holders of the light in a way that can really turn the tide? That's what we need. We need to turn the tide. And for me, you know, just taking a sort of a meta historical view for a moment, It's worth noting that since the Second World War, civil society has burgeoned around the world. Before the Second World War, there was probably no more than 20 or 30 civil society organizations. Now there are millions. There has been the liberation of the of women. There's been the liberation of the gays and the lesbians. I mean, for Bruce Jenner, decathlon Olympic champion in the 1970s, to become Caitlyn Jenner on the cover of Vanity Fair, shows that social transformation is possible if many, many people are willing to make the sacrifices at the personal level to make it so. So we have lots of examples. Aung San Suu Kyi in Burma, you know, the civil rights movement here. There's a lots of examples out there of meaningful social change when individuals come together in groups. The Social Benefit Corporation is an example. Another example, to the point of how civic units can transition, is the Transition Network. I mean, it started in a little town of Torness in England about 20 years ago, where one guy decided to go to the city council and get the city council to start going off-grid, to get off the oil-based economy, and he succeeded. And now there are thousands of cities and towns all over Europe, all over the United States, that are making local empowering decisions to disengage from the prevailing oil-based grid. Now, is that solving the overall problem? No. But occasionally we get victories, like Obama finally stopped the Keystone pipeline out of Alberta through the United States. The guy, Stephen Harper, now has been thrown out in Canada, and we have another, the son of Pierre Trudeau, as the prime minister, and apparently he's doing extraordinary things up in Canada right now. The United States is in many ways the heart of the beast. We have been the champion of capitalism and neoliberalism, and that's why we're so violent. That's why we're so disengaged from nature. That's why we're if we're not careful, could have a very serious, if not dictatorial, quasi-dictatorial government sooner than we can imagine, because our system is spinning out of control. So the contradictions are more real here in the United States, because we are the apex of the imperial system. So it's we're like Rome. You know, we're at the heart of the darkness that is empowering the coercive mechanisms of exploitation around the world. And how we move from transitional communities back into Washington, D.C., and make the real distinctions, I think Bernie Sanders would be as close as we could get at the current level of actual practical presidential politics. And I think everyone, without being too sectarian, should realize that there's a lot at stake in this election. Another example I would put forward is Apple Computer. Tim Cook is taking on the government around encryption, and he's now getting, because he was willing to take a stand, he's now getting other companies, major companies and small companies, that are banding with him. It looks like it's headed into the Supreme Court. But that's an example of where one company took a stand on government invasion of the iPhones and is refusing to allow the government to unencrypt the iPhones. So it can also happen in major corporate areas, but it ultimately comes down to individuals like Tim Cook, like Rosa Parks, like you on your radio station day after day after day, and now Bernie Sanders popping up out of nowhere, and, you know, an avowed democratic socialism. That's actually what the United States needs, is a governing system that allows democracy into the constitutional apparatus and into the economy, that sets the common good as transcendent over individual exploitative right.
One thing that could help Bernie Sanders, because he has a lot of problems with foreign policy, is if he were to get Jill Stein and ask, would she be his running mate? Because she's no Sarah Palin. She's smarter than all of them combined, and she is the progressive, but she has no power right now. That would give the progressives a base and give Sanders support from people that he would not otherwise have. So someone should put that in Sanders' ear as an idea. Jim Garrison, thank you for being on today, and all the best of all you're doing out there with the important work at Ubiquity University. And Jim's websites are ubiquityuniversity.org and wisdomuniversity.org. Dr. Jim Garrison. Nice to have you with us today, Jim.
Thank you.
Back in a moment with my next guest from Massachusetts, John Perkins. And we're going to talk about the new economic hitmen in politics and business, the people you don't know exist, who work behind the scenes and behind the headlines. Please stay with us. Let's go out to Massachusetts and say hello to John Perkins. Nice to have you with us today, John.
Oh, thanks, Gary. Good to be here. I'm actually in Washington, D.C. right now. But
all right. For many years, primarily through the 1970s and 80s, John Perkins was an economic hitman, a job to convince leaders of developing nations to accept economic conditions that benefit U.S. private and government interest. He was a direct participant or witness to such traumatic events as Saudi Arabian money laundering scandal, the fall of the Shah of Iran, the assassinations of Ecuador and Panama's democratically elected presidents, and other government and corporate intrigues. John was a chief economist for large international consulting firm, advising the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the UN, Fortune 500 companies, many national governments. But since leaving his covert activities, John has been a champion of indigenous spiritual cultures and environmental movements through his nonprofit project, Dream Change. And after 9/11, John broke his silence with the publication of his international bestseller that has just been fully revised and published as The New Confessions of an Economic Hitman, to explain that rather than a corrupt specialized activity among select consulting and international construction firms in the past, the system of economic hitmen has become more sophisticated, more devious, more widespread, even through the halls of government, and is now intentionally bankrupting the U.S. as it has done in the past with developing nations. His website is johnperkins.org. Now, John, several years ago, you were on the program to share your past experience as an executive economist and international hitman for a private consulting firm to advance the principles of disaster capitalism in poor developing nations. This was to make these nations' leaders obedient to free market capitalism and privatization of their resources to large Western multinational corporations and interest, and to increase U.S. government's imperial outreach. Now you're saying that this system of economic hitmen, which was rather small and virtually unknown to the public and probably most politicians in their days, is far more sophisticated, widespread, and catastrophic than ever before. So before we look at how the system has transformed through the U.S. government, the Congress, and become an embedded private corporations and the financial system, please briefly summarize first the system of economic hitmen and what its primary missions and long-term agendas were in the past when you participated in the system, and then explain the strategy the U.S. has followed for decades through the multilateral agencies like the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, to keep countries straitjacketed in huge debt as a means to colonize these nations' governments and economies. The forum is yours.
Well, thank you, Gary. Yeah, probably the best way to summarize this is to say that my primary job was to go into countries that had resources our corporations covet, like oil, arrange a huge loan to that country from the World Bank or one of its sister organizations, and the money from that loan would actually never go to the country. It would go to our own corporations to build power plants, industrial parks, highways, and ports in that country. So our own companies would get very rich in the process. And the projects themselves would help a few wealthy families, the ones who owned industries and the commercial centers. But the majority of the people would suffer. They didn't have enough money to buy much electricity, couldn't get jobs in industrial parks because they don't hire many people, didn't have cars to drive on the highways. And yet money that had been earmarked for their education, health care, and other social services would now be diverted to try to pay off the interest on the loan. And in the end, the principal could never be repaid. And that was part of the plan. So at that point, we go back in and say, hey, you know, since you can't pay your debts, sell your resource, oil or whatever, real cheap to our corporations without any social regulations or environmental restrictions, or privatize. Sell your electric utility, your water and sewage system, your schools, your jails, all of your public business sector businesses to our corporations. And that was, you know, really a way to create a new empire, a global empire. And it's really a corporate empire more than an American empire. And I would just add that in a few cases where we economic hitmen failed, and as you mentioned, I failed with the president of Ecuador, Jaime Roldós, and the head of state of Panama, Omar Torrijos. In those cases, the jackals would go in, and these are people who either overthrow governments or assassinate their leaders. Both Roldós and Torrijos, my clients, were assassinated. And, you know, there's a long history of this. Arbenz of Guatemala and Allende of Chile and Mossadegh of Iran, Lumumba of the Congo, Diem of Vietnam, so many heads of state and people in lower echelons that we've either overthrown or assassinated. It's a sad tale.
Could you bring us up to date on what's happening now with around the world where you see current presidents in right now where we have regime change and also how those jackals are working? And would Clinton, Secretary of State Clinton's actions in Libya and Ukraine be examples of the new jackal system that is deeply entrenched in governmental agencies?
Well, absolutely. Those two are very important examples. You know, Ukraine is a perfect example of a democratically elected president of Ukraine who began to become very socialistic and turned toward Russia and instead of the European Union and the United States, and so was overthrown in a coup. And then the European powers and the United States went in together and said, hands off, Russia. It's something that we promised not to do earlier, not to interfere with the former Soviet countries. I was just in that part of the world, especially in Romania, but where they fear similar things happening there. And I think something that most people don't realize is that Ukraine has probably the richest agricultural lands in that part of the world, and Monsanto has always wanted to get a hold of those lands and spread their GMOs throughout the region. Something similar in Libya. And I'd also like to say that I'm very personally familiar with what happened in Honduras just a little less than 4 years ago when the democratically elected president there, Manuel Zelaya, was overthrown because he tried to raise the minimum wage by 60%. And Dole and Chiquita and several of our athletic equipment producing firms took strong exception to that, tried to convince him not to go that route. And he refused to be convinced and was overthrown in a coup. So this continues. And as the new concessions of an economic hitman says, it's also come home to roost here in the United States and in Europe. The system's just spread radically in the last 12 years.
Could you also deal with Syria and what you see as being the agenda in Syria?
Well, you know, if we look at Iraq, Syria, Libya, these are places where both the economic hitman and the jackals have failed. Gaddafi and they had Assad, Gaddafi, and Saddam Hussein had very good security forces. They would not buy into the economic hitman deal because of their security, because they had lookalike doubles, et cetera. The jackals were unable to take them out, so the military went in. But there's also another more subtle thing that's been happening. If people think about oil, yes, that's true, but these wars make a tremendous amount of money for big corporations. And so while the economic hitman system seemed to be a great way to spread predatory capitalism around the world without the threat of war, and we were very successful with that through the 70s and 80s and into the 90s, at the end of the 90s, some of these big industries that had made a lot of money off Vietnam and off other war material began to feel left out of the picture. And so they were pushing very hard to get us into a more of a militarized situation. 9/11 provided the perfect excuse. So since then, in a way, we've gone back to the pre-economic hitman era when empires were formed by military force, and at the same time, we still have the economic hitman in there. So we've really got a double whammy going for us now.
John, when I look at the candidates in the present presidential race, most seem like they are simply puppets to the economic hitman system, such as Mark Rubio, Ted Cruz, Donald Trump. Seems to be the odd, Trump at least is the oddball, who is only a solo hitman serving his own interests. Yet when I look at Clinton, particularly Bill Clinton's economic legacy, particularly his free trade agreements and trashing Glass-Steagall, and then Hillary Clinton's legacy in the State Department in Ukraine, Libya, and Honduras, they both clearly align themselves consciously and intentionally with the economic hitman philosophy and mission. And these are not simply delusional puppets of the system, but highly respected policy leaders in their very system. Is this an accurate assessment, and could you assess the Clinton's past accomplishments in the context of the hitman philosophy?
Well, I'm really glad you bring that up, Gary. I just recently wrote a blog about the presidential elections, and you mentioned my website. People can get it on that, johnperkins.org. I think something all we Americans have to understand is that the president, whoever he or she is, has very limited powers. Symbolically, it may be important who we elect, but we've got to face the fact that the powers are very, very limited. And presidents are extremely vulnerable. You know, we saw Bill Clinton brought down in a political assassination. He was impeached. Back in Kennedy's day, he had to kill a president. But now we can bring them down by a sex scandal or a drug scandal, and they all know this. I think one of the reasons Obama has not been able to keep many of the things that he promised to do is because he's just prohibited from doing that. You walk into that Oval Office, and you're read the Riot Act, if you don't already know it, that you better play along with the system. So we got Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton become really part of the system. We get the Republicans who play along with the system. Anyone who tries to go up against it, and I think Obama may have tried to do that, may have had that intent originally, but very quickly realized he can't do it. And I think it's really important for we the people to understand that we're the ones who have to have the power. The big corporations are controlling the situation. They call the shots. You know, they provide money. Even if you get a candidate like a Sanders who comes along and doesn't take any money from them, perhaps, he's going to be surrounded by Congress people who have taken a lot of money from corporations who are dependent on them, and also surrounded by a great many lobbyists. Presidents are in very tough positions. So we need to understand that it's us, that the corporations have the power, and yet the corporations completely depend on you and me and all your listeners to buy their goods and services, invest in them, and allow our tax dollars and government policies to support them. We need to turn these corporations around. That is our greatest hope. And we, the people, have to take responsibility for that, not be diverted by this circus of the presidential elections.
I just see that behind every one of the major international crises are economic interest, and it is irrelevant who's in the White House. They control the system. Both corporate Democrat and corporate Republicans, and most notably this current White House, continues to favor multinational corporations and financial interests over the needs of Americans, even though these very same banks and corporations hold no true allegiance to the progress and well-being of this nation and its citizens. And we don't look at this for what it is. We'd like to believe that someone's going to ride to the rescue based upon what they're going to do, and it's not going to happen.
So, I totally agree with you.
Final thoughts of what you see we have to be paying attention to so we don't miss what's right in front of us.
Well, I think we have to understand that we've created a worldwide failed economy, what I call a death economy, an economy that's based on fear, debt, warfare, and destroying the resources that the economy depends on. We need to turn that around. Throughout history, revolutions have always happened because the reality was changed. People believe that the British were the strongest army in the world back in the 1770s, until finally Washington and Tom Paine and Tom Jefferson convinced them that they actually could defeat the British by hiding behind trees like Indians and shooting out at these lines of redcoats. And that changed everything. We're in a situation like that today where we've got to understand that corporations are driving this economic system. It's a failed economic system. It's a death economy. And incidentally, I work with a lot of corporate executives. I speak at a lot of corporate events. And most all of the corporate executives I know understand that this isn't working, but they don't know how to change it either. They're afraid that if they lose half a percentage of market share, they'll lose their jobs. So we, the people, have to let them know. You know, through social networking, through programs like yours, people need to get the message out there to these corporations that they're not going to buy from them unless they support a new type of economy, a life economy that's based on cleaning up pollution. It's based on creating new technologies that will recycle, that will no longer ravage the earth, technologies for energy, transportation, communications, banking, wholesale and retail trade. That will regenerate destroyed environments on this planet. There's a tremendous opportunity for us to turn this around. You know, imagine if we paid the industries that today are making weapons to instead make systems that would mine the plastic that's floating around out in the oceans, and they would create new types of agriculture that would, instead of destroying the earth through chemicals, would help starving people around the world grow food more efficiently. You know, we can really do this. There's a tremendous opportunity here, and you can probably hear my voice. I'm very excited about the prospects, but we have to recognize that we, the people, must do it. And in the new Confessions of an Economic Hitman, I devote a whole long section to how we can do this, including lists of what everybody can do. If every one of your listeners makes a commitment to taking action every day to turning this around, that's how it will happen. It will not happen because of who we elect as president.
Absolutely, I agree. John Perkins' website is johnperkins.org. His book is The New Confessions of the Economic Hitman. John, thank you, and all the best. I look forward to our next conversation.
Thanks, Gary, and I just want to point out I'm speaking in New York and San Francisco in the next couple of weeks, and that's all on my website if people want to just come in and join me at the Strand Bookstore in New York this coming Monday or whenever.
Great. johnperkins.org lets you know where he's at. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day.
Oh, what you gonna do? You wanna get down? Tell me. Oh, what you gonna do? Do you wanna get down?